Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of The Julia LaRoche Show. We have a returning guest. We are joined today by Whitney Tilson. He is a former hedge fund manager and now editor at Stansberry Research. In this episode, we get Whitney's take on the economy and the markets and why he's constructive on both, and he sees sunny skies ahead. We also do a dive into some stock picking ideas in this environment, including his bull case for Berkshire Hathaway and Meta. And we also revisit some of those mental mistakes that investors make, including some of the mistakes that he made throughout his time running money. I really enjoyed this conversation with Whitney. I learned a lot, and I think you will too. Whitney Tilson, editor at Stansberry Research. It is so great to welcome you back to the show. And Whitney, great to see you as always. Thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure. Good to be back.
Well, I'm excited to have you back. And the show's grown a lot since we last had you on. And so I'm excited for a lot of the new folks to get to know you. And Whitney, I'd like to start where I always start with my guest. And that is to get their big picture view of the economy. And let's also throw in the markets. And I know you're a value guy, but I just kind of want to step back and understand, like, how are you looking at the world, the economy today, and also markets? And Whitney, take all the time you need to set the table, if you will.
Yeah, well, my general view is pretty constructive. The U.S. economy, I think, has performed shockingly well, you know, given the, you know, the COVID crisis, then the dislocations and supply chain disruptions and the spiking of inflation, then the huge Fed increase in interest rates at unprecedented speed, and just about every prognosticator predicted some sort of real economic slowdown, crash in the housing market, inability to get inflation under control, or a company getting inflation under control, but at the cost of a significant recession, et cetera, et cetera. If you could have scripted a dream scenario, that's what we've experienced. It's and nobody really predicted it. Now, I'll give myself a little pat on the back in that I've stayed pretty constructive on stocks and just said, hang in there. You know, I'm not as bearish as the consensus out there, but I certainly, had you told me that inflation would go from 9% to, you know, 3% and stable, maybe even heading a little lower, and yet unemployment remains at a 50-year low, we haven't had a recession, you know, economic growth is quite strong, et cetera, I wasn't that optimistic, and stock market hitting new highs, you know, what is it, 18 times already this year. Again, it's been pretty much a dream scenario. I will caution people, whatever your view on the economy is, tends to increasingly steady show be based on what your politics are. So back when Trump was president, Democrats had a more negative view of the economy than was warranted by the facts. And today is exactly the reverse. So one of the big cautions that I'm always telling my readers is don't let your politics influence your sound investment decisions. And for example, when a Democrat is president, to get overly bearish and sell all your stocks and, you know, go to gold or something like that. That's been exactly the wrong move, just as it was, you know, to sell all your stocks the moment Trump was elected, as a lot of Democrats did. The other big lesson I would take away, which is different from when I was running a hedge fund, the single biggest mistake I made running a hedge fund is I'm a value guy. And value guys, just by nature, always are predicting gloom and doom and projecting the worst case scenarios. And, you know, one of the major reasons I ended up closing my hedge fund was underperforming in the long bull market after 08 and 09. And so anytime I had a winning stock like Netflix, you know, it would double and I'd sell. I held a lot of cash. I had too big a short book. And so I didn't blow up. I went out of business just from fatigue of underperforming the market because I kept predicting another 08, you know, global financial crisis around the corner. And basically what I've been preaching to my readers, and I have a couple hundred thousand people who get my free investing daily, which, by the way, anyone can sign up for. Just Google, type Whitney Tilson Stansberry Research. I'll take you to the webpage. You just enter your email address. What I've been saying is, you know, about once every 10 years, there is a major shock to the system. And usually it doesn't happen super quick like COVID. The housing crisis, you know, unfolded very slowly. There was plenty of time to see that there was a massive bubble that was in the process of bursting. Same thing when the internet bubble burst. There was plenty of time to get defensive and get out. But that happens very rarely. Yet value guys like me predicted it every year and got defensive. It is very costly, I can tell you. Battening down the hatches, trimming the sails of your ship, predicting a major storm when in fact the skies are sunny. And so I'm seeing that happening today with a lot of my, you know, smart hedge fund friends, predicting, you know, forecasting a big storm and getting defensive. And I'm looking up at the skies and I'm seeing sunny skies. And so I think they're making a mistake, and they're making the same mistake that I made for, you know, the better part of 20 years when I was running a hedge fund. But, you know, and now at the ripe old age of 57, you know, I've got a little more investment wisdom and channeling a little bit more of my Warren Buffett side, which is, you know, by and large, it's not a very good strategy to bet against America. And particularly when things are going very well, when the macro picture is as strong as it is today, it doesn't make a lot of sense to get defensive.
Yeah. Okay. Also, when you were on last, I think I had you on January of 2023, you did say at the time that you thought stocks would go up 15 to 20% for the year. And there are a lot of folks who were coming on and they were talking about like recession and a pullback. So you did get that right. But it is interesting.
Yeah, it turned out I was a little too conservative. You know, the S&P was up 26% that year. But after the end of 2022, there were a lot of cheap stocks out there. It had just been a hideous year for the market. You know, Dow down, roughly speaking, Dow down 10, S&P down 20, NASDAQ down 30. And the average individual portfolio I read somewhere was down like 44%. So there was a lot of pain out there, and it created incredible buying opportunities. I don't remember, Julia, but I sure hope. I was certainly pounding the table in my free investing daily. I was giving away Meta as the buy of the year. And, you know, it's up 5x since then. So I don't know if you remember, but I sure hope I gave your readers that as one of my favorite stock picks at the time.
Yeah. Okay. So I have another question just on markets. And I kind of get the sense, Whitney, that in the past, at least, you have had a bit of a spidey sense, like you saw the internet bubble, housing, and you've made some prescient calls over the years. But like, you don't have any sort of spidey sense when you see markets at all-time highs. Gold at an all-time high, Bitcoin ripping to new highs. Like, yeah, it does feel a little perplexing, doesn't it? Not at all?
Yeah. It's funny. I just wrote about this a couple days ago in my daily and saying, yeah, there are definitely some warning flags out there. I would say, you know, just the market at an all-time high, given the state of the economy and so forth, I don't think is that unusual. I do not think stock valuations in general, they are high, but they are not in bubble territory. You know, usually I make fewer like big, broad market calls, but I nailed the top of the meme stock bubble. That was just so obvious. You know, could you, so one particular area, you know, with Bitcoin up so much, what it's tripled in the past year. And it's interesting. I would never short it, because there is no connection to any kind of intrinsic value that could correct it. It's just a pure speculative entity. And that means it could go up, you know, once it goes up 3x in the past year, there's nothing to prevent it from going 3x in the next year. But that certainly smells frothy. And I've just, you know, in my past two dailies, yesterday and today, I've included a write-up, the bull case for Bitcoin, from a friend of mine who's made 350 times his money on like a 1% position in Bitcoin that, you know, he put on 10 or 12 years ago. He's never sold any of it. And, you know, God bless him. That was a very smart speculation. And kudos to him for letting it ride through many boom and busts. You know, it's had a number of 50, if not 80% pullbacks along the way. But do I think after it's gone up 350x, and you know, what everyone acknowledges is just an instrument of pure speculation, you know, now is the time to get in? Heck no. Is my view on that. But generally speaking, I'm sort of letting the stocks like Meta, like Berkshire, you know, that I've owned for a while, If you know, the only time I'm selling those is if I really feel like we get into bubble territory, and we're not. So I'm letting things ride and sort of being opportunistic, picking my spots. You know, the old cliche, it's a stock picker's market. You know, when I was last on a little more than a year ago, you could have thrown a dart into particularly anything in the tech sector that had really gotten clobbered and generally made pretty good money. Today it's harder, but you know, investing isn't supposed to be easy, I suppose.
I have a question for you. Do you own any Bitcoin?
No, gosh, no.
No? Okay.
No, was it Buffett or Munger who said it's rat poison squared?
I think it was Buffett.
And Munger says rat poison squared.
Yeah.
If I could push a button, if I were czar and do what China's done and just ban the whole thing, ban all cryptos, I think it has been a net negative. Even though everybody who's ever owned it now at this price, of course, at an all-time high, has made money on it. It's just an instrument of pure speculation. And to the extent it does have any utility, it's all, virtually all negative in the sense that it's used for, on the dark web, and it's used for, hacking and extortion. And it's used by Hamas to buy, weapons of terror, et cetera, et cetera. So I think here the Chinese were smart to just ban it.
Whitney, before I get into like stocks, do you know what's going on with gold? I know you're a value guy, and so gold's probably not something you really follow, but do you kind of have an idea as to why is it hitting all-time highs? Is that
I can't give you a lot of insights there. Long ago, I pray in the church of Graham Dodd, Buffett, and Munger, and so you won't be surprised to hear that my views largely follow Buffett's, which is I view gold, and by the way, Bitcoin, and I put in the same category as a Rembrandt, which is it generates no cash flow. It is impossible to value. Now, gold does have some utility, but the vast majority of its value is just because people think it has value, right? I think at least Bitcoin and Ethereum I used to think they were worthless. I no longer think they are worthless in the same for the same reason that I think a piece of canvas with some oil paint on it, i.e. a Rembrandt, is not worthless, because enough people think it has value that it probably will have some value. Now, where that value goes, I tend not to own things that I don't think I can have some reasonable approximation of their value. So I'm never going to own any of those things. And that's okay. I think the key to being a successful investor is knowing what you're good at, knowing what you're not good at, and just stick to your sweet spot. And by the way, just owning an S&P 500 index fund, there's no shame in that. And I own some of that too, in addition to some of my favorite stocks.
Hey there, I hope that you are enjoying listening to this episode. If you can, please take a moment to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcast. And if you could leave us a rating and a review, it would help us so much in continuing to grow the show and bringing some incredible guests for these longer form discussions. Thank you so much for your support, and I hope you enjoy the rest of this episode. And one more Bitcoin one before I move into stocks. You said your friend had 1%, and they had, I don't know how many times they made their money. Who's the friend? Did you name the person, the letters, or secret?
I can't. Okay. He prefers to be anonymous, but was an investor. And he's, the strange thing is, he's a value guy. And so he and I crossed paths in the value investing world when he was running a hedge fund. And he did well enough, I think, on his Bitcoin alone that he retired, doesn't manage any outside money, but is determined to hold his Bitcoin, basically, he says, forever. And he's got enough of it at this point and has enough other assets. I think he made a very good argument 10 years ago, and I wish I'd listened to it. I mean, I had the Winklevoss twins on stage. I was standing next to them at my own conference when Bitcoin, if I recall, was at about $600. So it's been a hundred bagger since then. And it was at my value investing conference.
I think I remember that conference. It would have been like 2013-ish, around that time. Yeah.
Yeah. They were among my worst rated speakers that year. I didn't invite them back because the audience of value guys thought this was crazy. And, you know, I wish they'd sort of made the argument that, look, this is something very clever. It's well designed. It will have an appeal to a certain segment of people. And, you know, it anytime you can take a speculation on something that has 100x upside and 1x downside, i.e., you know, 100%. Anytime you can get into that kind of risk reward, you don't need a very high percentage chance of it working out of the upside for the expected value to work out. And then it's just a question of position sizing. So, you know, I've taken a number of speculations in my life where I knew it was likely I would lose all my money. But there was enough of a chance of a 10-bagger, let's say, if not more, that it made sense to put 1% of my portfolio in it.
Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned some stock picks earlier. Berkshire Hathaway. I know you've been an investor in Berkshire for a long, long time. And like you said, that you worship at the church of Graham Dodd and Buffett. I know you always go to the meeting.
And Munger.
And Munger, of course. It's Charlie Munger, the late Charlie Munger. And you also mentioned Meta. Can we talk about like the stock pick ideas? What are the opportunities that are most interesting to you?
Yeah. Well, look, I've always, you know, I'll always start with perhaps the stock I'm best known for. You know, back when I was first starting my hedge fund in 1999 at the peak of the internet bubble, I sort of made a name for myself in the investing world, particularly in the value investing world, by going to the Berkshire Hathaway meeting every year. I've been to the last, I don't know, I can't even keep track, somewhere between the last 25 and 27 Berkshire meetings, you know, minus COVID. And I started taking notes, publishing notes, transcribing speeches of Charlie Munger that had never been transcribed. I actually had the best collection of the Buffett partnership letters going back to 1958, such that when Alice Schroeder was writing her book Snowball about Buffett, and she was, I talked to Alice later as she was doing research for the book. She was sitting down with Buffett and said, "Could you give me a copy of your old annual letters?" And he laughed and he said, "Ask Whitney, he has the most complete copy." So if you Google Buffett partnership letters, you can find a PDF of them that's now out there available for anybody. Those are the letters that I originally got from some of Buffett's original LPs, you know, that I met, and they pulled the letters out of their basement. It was like finding the holy grail, you know, for value investors. And, you know, I compiled it and that's what's out there on the internet now. So, but I also made a name for myself. You know, I was writing for The Motley Fool at the time, pounding the table, saying, "Everybody, this internet thing is, the internet is real, but these stocks are in a bubble. Get out, buy Berkshire Hathaway, listen to Warren Buffett, et cetera." And so I've owned Berkshire, you know, dating back. The stock bottomed on the day the NASDAQ peaked on March 9th or 10th of 2000. That Friday, I made Berkshire. It bottomed at $40,500 a share, you know, down from $60,000 or $70,000 a year earlier. So, you know, there's just a massive shift of money out of anything value oriented into the tech bubble. So there was incredibly cheap stuff at the peak of the bubble, just outside of the bubble. And Berkshire was a good example of that. I made it 30% of my nascent hedge fund at the time. And was very, very public about it. And, you know, sure enough, the stock was up 50-60% within a couple months in the initial unwinding of that enormous bubble. So, you know, fast forward to today, you know, Berkshire's done well, somewhat exceeded the S&P 500 over the last, you know, 20 years or so since then, 24 years. And I think it will continue to do so, but it's not screaming by. You know, there have been five or six occasions over the last 25 years where the stock's been a 50-cent dollar. You know, today we recommended it back in December in our flagship Stansberry's Investment Advisory newsletter, which is more big cap conservative retirement stocks. You know, where we, you know, we've owned Hershey's for 10 years, Microsoft for 10 years. And it was time to put Berkshire back in the portfolio. And it was trading at about a 15% discount to intrinsic value. The stock's run up about 15% in the last few months. They just reported good earnings. So, you know, I'd say it's about 7% undervalued today. So what that means is buying Berkshire today, I think you'll do a few percentage points better than the S&P 500 over the next few years. So that's always, you know, I always share that as my first investment idea. for people for a good solid foundation to their portfolio. You could own the S&P 500 index. I wouldn't argue with that as a good solid diversified foundation. I think you'll do a little bit better with Berkshire, maybe add Berkshire on top of that. So that's where I'd start. And then I'm happy to talk about some other ideas that I think will do quite a bit better than the S&P 500, but aren't as safe as Berkshire either.
Yeah. Well, okay. So follow on to Berkshire. Two quick things. One, I think you might, and I don't know if this is official, you might have the record for the most number of questions asked at the annual meeting. I don't know. I feel like I interviewed you a few years ago.
Since you can now go, I think CNBC has a website where you can now go back and watch the video. It's searchable. So you can search, by my name, for example. And I think that goes back 20 or 25 years. And I've asked like 12 or 14 questions, which is more than anyone else. So I sort of figured out the game of the microphone in the overflow room, which had fewer people at it. So I was able to get my question in, So, little badge of honor, I suppose, for, an avid Berkshire guy like me.
I love it. We revealed that little tactic. I think I interviewed you.
I know. Ruined the game. So I haven't, they usually probably have 8 or 10 people at every microphone now, and only maybe 2 people, maybe 3 get to ask their questions. So, my lottery number hasn't come up the last few years.
I feel like someone should take like the partnership letters or whatnot. I feel like you could train a large language model. I don't know. Maybe you could have like an AI Buffett conversation or something with all of that wisdom. Man, maybe somebody's done that or was working on it. But wow, what a treasure to have all those letters.
Yeah. They're the Buffett partnership letters, which are like 1958 to roughly 1972 and all, when he closed the Buffett partnership. And then I think starting in 1974, you just have the Berkshire Hathaway annual reports with Buffett's annual letter, which are also very much, that would be the entire, half century of Buffett right there, or more than half century.
Mm-hmm. How did you get turned on to Buffett? Did Bill turn you on when you guys were in business school together? Like, how did you guys...
Yeah. It was actually after the business school. I went to Harvard Business School. I didn't overlap with Bill. We're actually friends from undergraduate at Harvard. He was 1 year ahead of me. He was 2 years ahead of me at HBS, which, of course, in a 2-year program means we didn't overlap. But, we were good friends. And it wasn't until after business school that I started taking interest in investing for the simple reason, necessity being the mother of invention. I had never had anything but debt in my life. My parents are teachers, and I took on debt for college, and then I took on debt for business school. Fortunately, married a woman who graduated from Harvard Law School. And so, we had 2 incomes and we were living in our grandparents' apartment in New York. So it wasn't until I graduated from business school in 94. And it was a couple years after business school that we finally paid off my business school debt. And then we just saved money. We lived very frugally and had 2 incomes and didn't have any rent to pay, which was always nice. And so, $10,000 accumulated in our checking account. And that had never happened to me in my life. And I remember calling out Bill, who had started up his first hedge fund, Gotham Partners, out of business school. He was one of only 2 people out of 800 people in his class to go into the hedge fund world. That's how new hedge funds were. What a contrast to today, right? And I called up Bill. And I said, well, I've got $10,000 to invest. What should I do with it? And he said, well, you need to learn about investing. And I remember his exact words. He's like, go read everything Warren Buffett's ever written, and you can stop there. That's all you need to know. And so I did. And I soon thereafter, went out to my first Berkshire annual meeting. And, I grew up in a family, an incredibly frugal family. My mom can squeeze a dollar till it screams, and she clipped coupons, and we never went out to restaurants, and we never wore new clothing. She only shopped at secondhand stores and all, which is one of the reasons, by the way, my parents are living a comfortable retirement today, which is every year for the past 60 plus years, they're 82 and 83 years old, every single year they spent less than they earned. That's the most important thing to having long-term financial security. It isn't being a clever investor. It isn't identifying Bitcoin in its early days and having some big score in the investing world. the single most important thing you can do, no matter what your income is simply live beneath your means. Whatever you earn every year, if you spend less than that, i.e. you are a net saver, and then ideally are clever enough to put that in some sort of retirement account, and just let that compound over time. Now, I hope you're smart enough, and my parents were smart enough to put it in some sort of stock index fund or something. They never bought a stock in their entire lives. And they're living very comfortably in their retirement. Simply the magic of saving every year and then having it compound with no investment genius whatsoever. Just basically index funds or TIA craft stuff. So I digress a little bit, but that's how I got nothing from my parents in terms of anything about investing. Nor did I have any interest undergrad. I was interested in business, knew I wanted to go to Harvard Business School, but I would get the Wall Street Journal and I would throw away, I would read the A and B sections and throw away the C section, the money and investing section. I'd never owned a stock, knew nothing about it. So it wasn't until, after business school, mid to late 90s, stock market had been doing well for many years. Bill turned me on to Buffett and it immediately resonated with me, the idea of hunting around and finding dollar bills that you could buy for 50 cents. Like, that's basically, you boil it all down, that's what, value investing and what Buffett is all about, what Buffett and Munger preach. And as Buffett says, it's the kind of thing you either get immediately or you never get. And I got it immediately. And, my journey began. I didn't stop with Buffett. Of course, I sat in on Joel Greenblatt's class at Columbia Business School. I discovered Seth Klarman's book, Margin of Safety, before the price went up to, $5,000 a copy or something. And read Peter Lynch's books and so forth, and, was really self-taught, and then had the somewhat foolish idea, but it worked out okay to hang out my shingle as the world's smallest hedge fund with $1 million under management back in 1999.
Yeah, well, you had some wonderful teachers along the way. And just going back to stock picks, you mentioned Meta earlier. What else? Fill us in. Like, what are the interesting opportunities for you today? What can you share?
I can share. We've had a sort of a marketing piece, but one of our newsletters recently has focused on stock exchanges, which, if you look around the world, not just in the U.S., they have been exceptionally good investments. Look, down in Brazil at the, BOSPY is, I think, the ticker or something, that runs the stock exchange down there. All over the world, if you look over the past 5, 10, 15, 20 years, had you bought the stock of the company that runs the stock exchange, you would have done much better than owning the index, the S&P 500 index, like in the U.S. Two sort of big cap stock ideas that I can share with your viewers are CBE Group, There's CBOE Global Markets, and CME Group. So, CME Group handles contracts for trading futures and options and so forth, agricultural commodities, that kind of thing. It's a $77 billion market cap business. Stock's done very well over time. Trades at 14 times revenues, which sounds crazy, but this company is so profitable, it only trades at 24 times earnings, PE. So it's sort of, I would argue, a GARP, growth at a reasonable price kind of business. It's just an exceptional business. CBOE Global Markets focuses more on options exchanges worldwide. It's a little bit smaller business at $19 billion in market cap. And trades, not quite as profitable, but trades at a similar sort of 26 PE multiple. It's interesting. I try and cast a pretty wide net as an investor, often buying, beaten down, hated stocks like Meta was, about 16 months ago, back in November. I wrote a 6-part series in my free daily. This was one we gave away to our free subscribers. Normally, you know, I sort of talk generally about markets and what's going on and in my free daily. And every once in a while, you know, like I talk about Berkshire and my latest analysis of Berkshire. But we generally save our very best stock picks for our paid subscribers in our various publications, our flagship being Stansberry's Investment Advisory, where we're focused on big cap blue chip stocks, you know, that I would put in my parents' retirement account, where, you know, CME Group and CBOE Global Markets would be two examples of that. And Berkshire, of course. But in this case, Meta had gone from, I don't know, $300 a share down to under $100 a share. And, you know, it was compelling enough that I gave it out as a freebie. In addition, it was in one of our paid products, but I wrote about it in my daily. And, you know, the stock's just been a monster.
Yeah. Okay. So you have some stock picks. Is there anything when you look at the market that you're kind of like, dang, I wish I bought that, or kind of kick yourself that you wish that you got in on, or do you not think like that as an investor?
I think too much of it because, you know, look, I will tell you, it's hard to practice what I preach, which is what Buffett and Munger preach, which is, you know, the 20 punch card concept, and just identify a handful of great businesses and look at Buffett's portfolio. You know, where he's owned Coke for 25 years and Amex and so forth. But then he discovered Apple and figured out that was an insanely great business. You know, he tells the story, I think, of where Bill Gates lost his iPhone on a trip and was in an absolute panic and would have paid any amount of money, you know, to get back to find his phone or whatever, and realized, holy cow, right? This is something absolutely essential. He cites that as, you know, one of the things that helped him realize what an incredible franchise Apple had and got into it. And now it's like 40%. He's probably made more money on Apple, like well over $100 billion on that one investment.
And people probably thought he got in late, I imagine, too, when he took it in. Yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, that's a good lesson. You know, they say the four most dangerous words in investing are "this time is different." My addition to that is that the three most dangerous words in investing are "I missed it." And Buffett didn't look at Apple, which was then one of the most valuable companies in the world, I don't know, 5 years ago or whenever he got in, and he didn't say "I missed it." He said, you know, this is an incredible company and it's going to do well over time, and you know, backed up the truck. So look, I owned Apple. And you can actually Google what I was writing back in 2000. Steve Jobs had already come back to the business to fix it. The company had a net cash position, and it had something like a $3 billion market cap. I actually owned it at 35 cents a share, adjusted for 56-for-1 multiple splits, totaling 56-to-1. So, you know, the actual stock was, I don't know, at $15 or $16 at the time. And I wrote about it publicly in my Motley Fool columns and said, you know, Apple's not going away. They've got a good balance sheet. They're not losing money and they've got a net cash position. And Steve Jobs is a pretty innovative guy and they've got a core base of loyal customers. So this was, you know, this was 17 years. What was it? No, the iPhone came out in 07. So this was 7 years before the iPhone, of course. Couldn't have predicted that. But you know, I owned Amazon and wrote about it publicly at a split adjusted $2.41 a share. I owned, you may even remember, you were probably at my Value Investing Congress where I got on stage. Netflix had fallen from, this was pre-7-for-1 split, but it had peaked at 300 and had fallen to 53 3/8 on October 2nd of 2012. Which happened to be the date of my annual Value Investing Congress in New York. And I went on stage and I showed Company A and Company B. And I compared the two and they were very similar. Both had a $3 billion market cap, both had about $3 billion in revenue, but Company B had a net cash position, had higher margins, et cetera, et cetera. So both were growing rapidly, both had 40% growth rates, et cetera. And Company A was Amazon 10 years earlier in 2002, and Company B was Netflix today, that being in October 2012. And I said, and so my conclusion was, is, and by the way, Amazon over the previous decade at the time I gave this presentation had been a 20 bagger. And I said, I think Netflix is this upcoming decade's Amazon. And so I, you know, stuck my neck out there and said, this could be a 20 bagger in the next 10 years. And it turns out I was completely wrong. It was a 91 bagger in 8 years. The stock went from split adjusted at the time, you have to divide by seven for the subsequent stock split. So it was trading at 778 a share that day, happened to be the day it bottomed. Not that I caused the bottom. I was more lucky than good, I think. But it was about 2 weeks later that Carl Icahn got into it and the stock popped about 10 or 15%. And I remember some of my friends emailing me. It's like, stock's already up 15, 20%. Icahn's in. I've missed it. And I was like, no, you haven't. And it certainly had. You know, stock went from basically 7 to 700 over the next 8 years on pretty much a straight line. And so, you know, this gets back to your question, you know, what are my regrets or whatever? Is my regrets are not, my regrets aren't so much the stocks I missed, because I was in most of them at one point or another. You know, I owned Home Depot 20 years ago. I owned McDonald's 20 years ago. And the only one I held on for the entire period was Berkshire. And had I just had the good sense to hold on to a half dozen other obviously great stocks, obviously great companies that were doing fantastically well. But I just, I had this silly idea in my head that, oh, I don't want to be greedy. You know, the stock's already doubled or it's quadrupled or something. You know, it must be time to sell. And that's completely the wrong attitude. You have to be greedy. You, in any 10-stock portfolio, in any 20, 30, 50, 100-stock portfolio, a handful of stocks are going to drive the entire return of your portfolio. But you don't really know which ones they are. But when you catch a tiger by the tail, when you catch lightning in a bottle, when a stock just starts performing massively better than you could expect, you must be greedy. You need to own that for the long term. Because here's the thing, the simple math, and by the way, the reason the S&P 500 index beats virtually every active money manager over time is simple math. The S&P 500 index has never sold its Apple stock. It's never sold its Amazon stock. It's never sold its Microsoft stock. It lets its winners run. And almost no active money managers have the patience and the discipline to do that. They truncate their winners. So if you look in any 10-stock portfolio, two stocks are going to drive the entire return. But that's only true if you own them and don't sell them after they double. You need to ride them 5x, 10x, 100x, just a handful of those stocks. So in fact, there have been studies of the entire U.S. stock market going back the last century. And the basic conclusion is like 1% to 2% of the stocks are responsible for 98% of the entire profits of the entire stock market. Index funds, by definition, are always going to own those 1% to 2% of stocks, the index fund will let them ride. And almost no active manager does that. So what we end up as active managers is we're in the hideous position of we pick our flowers and we water our weeds. You know, there's sort of a joke about, hey, I got two kinds of stocks in my portfolio. I got my winners and my long-term holds. Right. And there's everyone laughs, but because it's so true, right? You know, our stocks that are doing poorly and we've lost half our money. Okay, we're gonna hold on and they'll come back someday. And meanwhile, we've got some unbelievable companies and the stocks are ripping and we don't want to be greedy. So we're selling those and we're holding or adding to the losers. And of course, you should be doing precisely the opposite. And look at what Warren Buffett's done with Apple. He's not only let his winner run, he's added to the position over time. I mean, only recently, now that he's made more than $100 billion, and it's something like 47% of his entire stock portfolio, has he even started to trim a little bit. And, you know, we should all learn from that.
Yeah, well, let your winners ride. You know, it makes me think, what you're kind of going over, like, probably like more of the mental mistakes that investors make. And even in you're sharing some of the lessons you learned in your career, I think you closed your hedge fund in 2017. Do you ever like think back and like, wow, if you were running money today or running a hedge fund today, like how you would do it differently? Or Do you ever miss or regret closing, or like wish you were still running? Sound like I'm sensing a lot of like wisdom coming from you today.
Yeah, yeah. I do think I would be a better investor today for sure if I were doing it, but I'm not tempted to get back into it. In that, managing other people's money is quite stressful. It's a real obligation, you know. I'm at age 57, I guess. I'm willing to trade off, the upside of, the 2 and 20 comp structure really can't be beat. If you look at, there are two places where more billionaires have been created, centimillionaires / billionaires have been created faster by people at a younger age than at any time in history. And that would be in the hedge fund business and in the tech startup, sector. So basically highly concentrated in, 2 square miles of New York City and 2 square miles of Silicon Valley. Sadly, 98% of the money that has been made in this extraordinary place of wealth has been by men. And women have been largely shut out of these two worlds. And that's another podcast you and I should do. We could have a very interesting conversation about that. I have written about that. I have 3 daughters now in their 20s in the working world. And so, I've given a fair amount of thought to, where the best opportunities for them are, and would I encourage them to follow my footsteps into the hedge fund business, in the money management business, for example. And I'm not sure the answer to that question is yes, by the way. I think working at a larger firm, my oldest daughter, for example, spent 4 years at EY in the consulting area. And I think at a larger firm that has an HR department, for example, women are more likely to get a better shot. But again, I digress. Because my job today as an investment newsletter publisher is to write a good, provocative investing daily, and then come up with one good stock idea a month for Stansberry's Investment Advisory, which is our flagship newsletter. We have more than a dozen newsletters, but there are other analysts and so forth who are primarily responsible for them. So my job involves reading and writing and thinking. It does not involve a lot of meetings, doesn't require a lot of business travel. So as you probably know, being on some of my personal email lists, or following me on Facebook, I have an extremely high quality of life that I could not have if I were managing other people's money, just because there's too much, performance, short-term performance pressure and so forth. The things that, I love to travel, I love to get involved with various philanthropic things. I've been to 12 countries in the last 30 days. I cherish that quality of life that I have, and the investment newsletter business is a good business, and we do well with it. And I don't need to be sitting here in New York to read and write and think. So I do that, as I travel around the world and try and make a difference in the world and do things that are important to me personally. So I'm not tempted to get back into the business. If I did, though, I would run it more like the way I always said I was running it, but didn't really end up doing it. I just didn't have the patience and the discipline to just own 8 stocks or 10 stocks the way Warren Buffett has always done it, the way Bill Ackman does it today. I think that is not only offers you the best quality of life for sure, but is the only way to beat a passive index, to beat the S&P 500. is identify a handful of great companies that are likely to outperform and then just sit on your butt. It's very painful to me when I look back at my last 5 years of underperforming the market from 2013 through 2017 when I closed my funds. And at the beginning of 2013, I had a 5% position in Netflix at about $10 a share at that time. It had bounced 50% from its lows, from a little under $8 a share to maybe it was $10 or $12 a share. If I had forgotten that I was in the money management business and just gone on vacation for 5 years, I would have had and just let Netflix run. But I had a couple other winners that I didn't let run either that did well. It didn't matter that two or three of the 12 stocks I owned at the time basically, you know, did very poorly. One or two went to zero. It didn't matter as long as I had a couple big winners and let them run. But I didn't have the patience and the discipline to do that. Now, I'd like to think if I were to get back into the business today, I would.
Yeah. Well, you know, Charlie Munger always called it the sit on your ass investment strategy.
Right.
And I want to, we don't have much time, but let's end on a Charlie Munger question and his legacy. I feel like, Whitney, Charlie is kind of like this generation's Benjamin Franklin. I feel like he will be quoted in 100 years. People will still be quoting him.
Yeah.
That's just my impression. Can you leave us with some of your thoughts about his legacy?
Yeah. Well, Munger was, you know, the indispensable right-hand man of Buffett for 50 years, and it had a big influence on Buffett. And in turn, the two of them are, you know, think of it as the Pope and the senior cardinal of a global church that has its annual gathering, you know, in Omaha every year. They've had enormous influence on so many investors, but also just on the people. And I originally discovered them because I wanted to make money. I wanted to be successful as an investor. But the impact the two of them had on me over the years had a much bigger sort of impact on my life and just the way they lived their life, et cetera. So Munger in particular, I mean, Buffett probably just because he was more outspoken and there's just more Buffett to learn from. But I always made it a point to go to the Wesco annual meeting and hear just Charlie. And I sort of became obsessed with him and found recordings. Like, this was back pre-internet days. They were literally on DVDs of the 24 causes of human misjudgment and all. And in fact, I wrote one of my books, my latest book called The Art of Playing Defense, which was life advice that I wrote for my daughters. So I've written three investing books, including I was a contributor to Poor Charlie's Almanac, the definitive book about Charlie Munger. And of the original 10 speeches of Charlie's that form the core of that book, five of them were speeches that I had originally discovered and transcribed. So when Peter Kaufman was putting the book together, you know, I had the opportunity to contribute to it. There
this
it is right
one.
There.
Yeah, you're in this one.
And of course, I have my copy right
mine's
here.
Signed
and
by Charlie.
Look at this is all of Charlie's wisdom. These little yellow sticky pads are the highlights, the most important things. And you can see I must have 50 of them stuck into the binder of this book, where I've written little notes to myself about his comments on money management, on why there are so few imitators of Buffett and Munger, on irrationality, on the importance of having patience, his famous quote about, well, I'm right and you're smart, so eventually you'll come to see things the way I do. That was
one of the
funny things he would always say to Buffett whenever they disagreed. I'm right and you're smart. So look, the biggest impact, you know, big picture, is the entire framework of thinking about always invert and looking to avoid calamities. So the book I wrote, so I'll grab a copy right here. It's called The Art of Playing Defense. You know, it's available on Amazon. And if you're like me,
you only
listen to it on Audible. I'm actually the narrator of it.
I listened to your audiobook. That's how I did it.
Yeah. And I haven't actually read a paper book in probably 5 years, but I listened to at least one book at 2.75x speed on Audible, about one book a week. So I read 50 books a year. I listen to 50 books a year. I read no books a year. Because it's a much more efficient way, I find, to go through books by listening to them at high speed, like when I'm riding my bike or jogging in the park or whatever.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. People think going to the front line in Ukraine is dangerous. I'm telling you, riding my bike in New York City is the most likely
thing. Listening to an audiobook,
to get me, yes. But this book, The Art of Playing Defense, the whole title of it is Channeling Charlie Munger, which is, if you want to be successful in life, for my daughters, most of my peers and so forth, we've got a reasonable education, a reasonable income. We don't have to worry about, you know, a roof over our heads or feeding ourselves, right? So once you've reached a certain point in life, and this is, I'm directly quoting Charlie Munger here, is you should be thinking about what can send you back to go, what can wreck an otherwise happy and successful life, and then be very deliberate in avoiding those things. So Charlie was always preaching and talking about, you know, you just open the newspaper every day and you see some happy, successful person who has been brought to ruin because they crossed some legal or ethical line, destroyed their reputation. They have ruptured relationships with their children or their parents or their spouse. They had a good marriage and they let it go bad. They smoke, and then they get lung cancer and die at a premature age, and or the last 10 years of their life are hooked up to a ventilator and they're miserable for something that was completely obvious and preventable, which is, now it wasn't a very good idea to smoke a pack of cigarettes a day for decades, right? So he was always talking about that, and it really has had a big influence on my life, to the point where I wrote this book for my daughters. And instead of being all the things you need to do to be successful, the five primary chapters of this book are the five calamities. I sort of took all the calamities from my observation, but also, you know, what I've learned from Munger, and figured out, you know, these five areas cover 90% to 99% of human misery. And I'm just going to read them to you quickly. Loss of reputation or wealth, loneliness and or suffering a permanently impaired relationship with a loved one. Number three, a bad marriage, often ending in divorce. Number four, addiction and abuse. And number five, the death, serious injury or illness of yourself or a loved one. So it's actually pretty hard to think of something that can derail an otherwise happy and successful life that doesn't fall into one of those five categories. So that's, you know, I started putting this together when about 10 years ago, when all of my friends and family seemed to be getting divorced, going through midlife divorces. So, you know, statistically speaking, the single year where divorce is most likely is your first year. And then there's a period of time where, okay, if you haven't gotten divorced in the first few years, you're probably good. And then for a while you have kids and whatever, and most people don't get divorced when the kids are young. But then you start to reach middle age, you start thinking about, okay, we'll be empty nesters. Is this the person I want to spend the last 50 years of my life with? And the kids are sort of old enough, that you can sort of rationalize, they'll be able to deal with it, you know, now that the kids are, you know, over age 10. So I started seeing a lot of divorces, and I was like, wow, I really don't want that to happen to me. And so that was sort of the calamity that I originally focused on and wrote up some slides and have a chapter in my book on. But that sort of led me down, you know, a number of years worth of thinking and writing and presenting these ideas to different audiences. And ultimately, I ended up, you know, writing a book about it.
Yeah, well, who you choose to be your spouse is the most important decision. And I got to say, Whitney, such a pleasure to have you back on. I really appreciate you taking the time. Whitney Tilson, editor at Stansberry Research. Thank you again.
My pleasure.